Okay. So welcome everyone, and we've been here some days now, and it's very inspiring to be with all of us in practice together. And at this point, both Don and I have seen you all in small groups. In the next few days, we'll see you all individually. And we've been very touched and moved with the heart. There's a beautiful quote from Hafiz, a Persian poet, that says, How did the rosebud ever open and feel the... How did the rosebud open and receive the light of the world? And it said it felt the encouragement of the light against its being. Felt the encouragement of the light against its being. So I feel like we're bearing witness to the rosebud opening, feeling that encouragement of the light of awareness, the light of compassion. So... sometimes people ask me, well, do you get drained with retreats? And it's like, it's like so life-giving, because it's like so real, it's genuine, it's authentic. It's, yeah, sometimes it's really hard what we might hear, the pain, but it's real. So, very life-giving and honor. So I'll start with a poem from William Stafford, and this is the last poem that he ever wrote. It was written 3 days before his death, and he knew he was dying. There's a thread that you follow, and it goes among the things that change, but it doesn't change. And people wonder about what you're pursuing. And you have to explain about the thread, but it's hard for others to see it. But while you hold it, you can't get lost. Tragedies happen, people get hurt or die. You suffer, you get old, and nothing you can do can stop time's unfolding. Nothing you can do can stop time's unfolding, but you don't ever let go of the thread. To me, the thread speaks of our practice. Nothing you can do can stop time's unfolding, but else you don't ever let go of the thread. Many years ago, I had a life-threatening, rapid illness, infection, bacterial infection. I had to have emergency surgery, and I was told that I could go into respiratory arrest, septic shock. The doctor kept on asking, well, how's your breathing? And I go, I'm breathing in and out. And fortunately, didn't go into respiratory arrest, nor septic shock, but they had to do surgery, and they said it's possible that I could die or lose my leg. Fortunately, I have my leg in life. I have a big whopping scar at the end of the retreat. If anybody wants to say big whopping scar on my foot, I'm happy to show you. I had what's known as flesh-eating bacteria or necrotic fasciitis. And when it came time for the surgery, I asked the surgeon and the nurses all in the room, I said, before we do this, can we stop for a few moments? And I just want to thank you. I don't know what the outcome is, but I want to thank you, and can we have a moment of silence? And I have this little Buddha with me, and can you tape it to my chest? Which the doctor did. I was very grateful. And so we took that pause. And then the anesthesia medicine came on. They asked you to count 100, 99, 98. It was like yeah, I was out. And I was so grateful to wake up alive in the intensive care unit, and all went well. And I had to have some further surgeries, what's called debridement surgeries. But all went well, and but I really felt that if I was going to go, I wanted to have the Buddha on my heart. Like that was for me personally, that thread. And I think one of the things that's powerful about taking refuge in the Buddha Dhamma Sangha, you're taking something refuge even more than just about yourself. Something perhaps for me higher, aspiring for awakening and the teachings of awakening, the community that awakens. So I'm going to continue the story of the sojourn of Siddhartha Gautama. And I, in the last talk, spoke about the messengers and his realization that he wanted to devote his life to understanding the meaning of life and left the palace, renouncing his world to become a king. And thus began some of the journey of this current Buddha. But even before that, I want to just speak about some of the earlier roots. So, you know, like in Star Wars, it says somewhere in a faraway off galaxy. Well, a number of eons ago, and sometimes an eon is measured in Buddhist philosophy as what it takes for a bird to fly over the highest mountain in the world and brush their wing against the mountain once every 100 years, and it gradually flattens that mountain into a plain. Long time ago, in a faraway galaxy, there lived this just very beautiful person named Sumedho. And at that time, there was another Buddha. So the Siddhartha Buddha is just in line of countless Buddhas of the past, countless Buddhas of the future. And this particular Buddha's name was Dipankara. And Sumedho saw Dipankara, the Buddha, coming towards and was so incredibly inspired. And then saw there was a kind of a big muddy puddle that Dipankara was walking towards. And for whatever reason, Sumedho decided, I'm going to go lie down in that puddle and let the Buddha walk over me. I want to just honor his feet. And so he lied down. This type of devotion sometimes people have, inspiration. And so he lied down. And as the Buddha, Dipankara Buddha, walked over him, Sumedho had this aspiration that I too want to become a Buddha like Dipankara. And it said that after Dipankara walked over Sumedho, Dipankara Buddha turned back to him and said, Sumedho, you will become a Buddha, and your name will be Gautama Buddha. And at that point, Sumedho took on this vow or these deep intentions to become a Buddha, and from lifetime to lifetime had to develop qualities, sometimes known as the paramis or the perfections of cultivating generosity and virtue and renunciation, wisdom and energy, patience, resolve, truthfulness, loving kindness, equanimity. These are called these perfections that are developed through lifetimes. There's actually a beautiful book in the canonical literature called the Jataka Tales. And it describes the many lives of what's known as the Bodhisattva, one who's aspiring to become a Buddha. 547 Jataka Tales, where sometimes he was born as a bird, as a lion, as a human, as all different types of beings, but all in this spirit of developing these qualities of generosity, virtue, renunciation, wisdom, and so forth. Till eventually it seemed that the perfections were in a ripe enough way, and so Siddhartha Gautama was born, destined to become a great king, and then encountering these four heavenly messengers, recognized that he wanted to devote his life to understanding the meaning of life. Kind of interesting to hear some of the cosmology. And so it's said that, you can hear me okay, yeah. Siddhartha left the palace, shaved his head, put on rag robes, and wandered and heard about different meditation teachers and began to practice with them. And he was a very diligent and sincere, genuine student, and practiced very intensively. At that time, what was very prevalent in northern India was mostly the practices of concentration meditation. And these are types of practices that you bring your awareness to one object, and there's different levels of absorption and unification. In Pali, they call this like four material jhanas, which are absorptions, and four immaterial. But it has to do with developing profound absorption, unification, oneness with an object. And the results of that can bring upon incredible tranquility, serenity, oneness, and more. I won't go into it in much more than that, but that's, you're getting the drift. And Siddhartha became a very adept student with the development of these absorptions, and so much so that from one teacher to the next that he practiced with, often Siddhartha's teacher would say, all right, you've learned everything that I've learned, and why don't you stay with me, and we'll teach together these practices of concentration and absorption, unification, oneness, infinite of space and consciousness and neither perception nor perception and so forth, vastness. And no doubt Siddhartha could develop these qualities or these practices and experienced these vast, serene, tranquil spaces within, but he also realized that he's still in reconciling with these messengers of aging, illness, and death. He still felt that he didn't fully understand about these things and what this all is. So he, you know, appreciated these wonderful benefits of concentration, but he still was searching. And so then he had heard that it was through self-mortification, the punishing of the body, that this was the way to enlightenment. And so he joined a group of five ascetics that were practicing very severe types of self-mortification practices. Siddhartha decided to take on this practice of limiting his food intake. And through a long, long period of time, he limited his food intake down to one grain of rice a day. And that's what he lived on for a long period of time. So you can imagine that he was losing weight, eventually getting very skeletal. It said at one point, almost if he felt his abdomen, he almost could feel the tailbone, not good. And his energy was weakening, and he began to realize that if he continued in this way, he would die. And so he recognized that this is too extreme for him. And there's got to be some type of a middle way. And so he, with the limited energy that he had left, he left these group of ascetics who thought that, oh, Siddhartha, he went off on the deep end. And but anyway, Siddhartha knew that he needed to leave. And on the way, just, you know, he, probably not too far away because he was so weakened, but somehow he came across this incredibly kind woman named Sujata. And she saw how weakened this ascetic was. And she said, can I help you? And he, yes, thank you so much. And so she helped him, giving him food and helping to take care of him till he regained his strength and his vitality. We have to give such deep thanks to Sujata. And so at a certain point, having his health returned and his vitality, he bid farewell to Sujata for the time being, and he went on this sojourn, just traveling here and traveling there, and eventually he saw this tree that he felt connected to or something drawn to. And so he came up to this tree, and it had kind of a view of a pastoral view setting to some degree. And he decided this is a good tree. This is a good place to sit. And as he took his seat, he began to feel like some determination. He felt the earth right below him, the tree right behind him, and some inspiration, like a resolve arose that I'm going to stay here. And then this recollection, I've been to so many different teachers and seen and practiced so many different teachings, and it's time now to see for myself with my own direct experience. And gave thanks to all of his teachers and teachings, but it was time now to see for himself. What is this? And this deep resolve, like even I'm going to sit here till my bones, my skin falls off my body. I mean, this really, at this point, having studied so many different practices, and let me just stay and see with my own investigation, my own practice. A very powerful resolve. And it said that as he began to sit, a memory arose within him that he had forgotten. But perhaps it was simulated because he was sitting underneath the tree and it was this beautiful day, and the memory was about him being a young boy and sitting underneath another tree overlooking a very pastoral, beautiful area. And so he recalled that memory of him as a boy sitting underneath this tree, and then and it evoked this sense of feeling this oneness with the world. It's a beautiful feeling, and I trust all of us in beautiful moments can feel that sense of oneness with the world. So he was just remembering that experience of as a boy with that oneness of the world, and it was giving him access to feeling that sense of oneness with the world right now as well. So this is reminiscing, this remembering of this connection with the world. And then pondering that for a while, sitting with that for a while, resting in that for a while, if you will, another memory that he had totally forgotten also began to bubble up. And it was that same day, sitting underneath that tree and feeling that oneness with the world. And then this other memory, he began to remember that as he looked in a certain direction, there was an agricultural field, if you will. There was some plows and oxen. And perhaps maybe because his sensitivity was so heightened, feeling this oneness with the world, when he saw, he's remembering now, when he saw the plow blade enter into the earth. Again, maybe because his sensitivity was so heightened, he could almost hear the sounds of the worms crying in pain, in agony. And in that moment, like he just realized, like it's such a juxtaposition, the oneness of the world, and then this also heartbreak. Deep heartbreak. And this was connecting him now back as well into the messengers of aging, illness, death. Even as a boy, he's recalling this memory of this oneness and this heartbreak. And now, so many years later, sitting underneath this tree, recalling these memories, and then beginning to settle some more and beginning to become mindful of his breath in and breath out. As I mentioned, he was has been a very adept meditator, developing deep, profound absorption and concentration, and he could feel himself kind of moving in that direction. But then he thought, perhaps because of this recalling of the heartbreak of the world, maybe I'm going to change the focus of my meditation. Rather than going into complete absorption, I'm going to become aware of as the breath comes in and goes out, beginning to penetrate impermanence. You will find in the Four Foundations of Mindfulness, embedded within the teachings many times, is to be aware of the origination and the dissolution, the rising, the falling, the ephemeral, the effervescent, ever-changing, impermanent nature of things. And so he began to meditate on the breath in and out and beginning to penetrate impermanence. And he had never done this ever before, and he had never heard of anyone meditating and doing that type of thing. It was always about absorption, oneness, and unification. But something called to him to be aware of this beginning and ending, this breath in and this breath out. And then something happened. We could call it a profound realization. And that realization that became later known as a noble truth. But I like the word realization. It was an insight. It was an understanding. And this first one was a very humbling, incredibly sobering, incredibly painful recognition that heartbreak and suffering exists. There is just, in his own heart, This is the truth. There is pain in this world. And it kind of just stopped him. It's this recognition, this validation of the truth of suffering. It goes on. It doesn't end there. But it's really powerful to really, like he just, this was true. I'm not fond of the word, but the word like heartbreak really kind of this truth of suffering. And we have many words for it here: anguish, stress, dissatisfactory. I mean, there's a lot of words to describe it. Heartbreak again. And so he just sat with this for a while, this sobering recognition of the truth of suffering. Being separated from those that you love. those that you love that have died, being in difficult situations, bodily pains, mental pains. I mean, we know the list. So there's a sobering and very humbling recognition of this truth, this fact, if you will. And yeah, and then he began to get really curious. What is this? He began to reflect upon, again, penetrating into impermanence, the breath in and breath out, like causes. So the qualities that we speak of, these factors of awakening, of mindfulness arose, and investigation, and energy, and getting into this. And then something happened. Siddhartha realized something, understood something, that the cause of all of this is unawareness, ignorance, not seeing clearly into the nature of things. And that it, not only that, that it gives rise to misconception, perhaps the belief that find happiness outside of oneself rather than inside, but that the primary cause is ignorance or delusion or unawareness or heedlessness, not mindful, not aware. My teacher, Tunpu Lucetto, he used to say, the midnight is dark, the new moon is dark. At night, the thickness of the forest when there's no moon is dark. But he would say, darkest of all is unawareness, is ignorance. That's why this practice of cultivating our awareness is so vital to support understanding. And so within this understanding of ignorance or unawareness, it gives rise to misconception. That misconception that we can find perhaps some happiness and pleasures, and we begin to cling to them, begin to crave them, and so forth. This belief that happiness or whatever can be found outside of us. And I want to acknowledge, I think for every one of us, for most everyone, I think it's fairly common for us to want to be happy, have a longing to be whole, to be home, to be loved, to have ease. And I think the question the Buddha was exploring was, where is that to be found? Even in our mythology, we have the concept of utopia or Shangri-La, the places of paradise, the oasis, places we can find rest. And no doubt it's wonderful if you're in a desert to find an oasis is a great thing. But it's interesting that in the Greek word, utopia, it's a Greek word, it, as I'm used to find out that it actually means nowhere. It's like a mirage, nowhere. But in English, we can play with that word, nowhere, and we could separate a little bit, and maybe there's a hint inside there that says now here. Utopia, nowhere, or maybe now here. Don't know. Even the word desire, it's kind of a play of things. It's like from the Latin root is desidere. It's like from the stars, what the stars will bring. Even though we're actually made of atoms that come from stars, but somehow there's a sense of what the stars will bring is some of the root definition for desire. And if we continue to live with the belief that somehow happiness can be found outside of us, perhaps we'll continue to spin around and around. But it kind of tricks us because there are things that really feel good. We were talking about that yesterday, and, you know, what do I do in the pleasant feeling tone? And, yeah, we are wired with our senses to feel good. And perhaps this is the root of addiction, because something that feels good, there's a tendency to want to just have more of it. A friend of mine who's now a therapist and a meditation teacher, and earlier in her life, she was a heroin addict. We were once having tea one day, and I was very curious because I haven't tried heroin. Did have some morphine when I was in the hospital, but that was a different experience. It was just numbing the pain. But I asked her, what was your experience on heroin? And she said, Bob, it was the best feeling I ever had in my life. And all I know is I want more and I want more and I want more. And I kept on injecting and I kept on injecting, I kept on injecting, but it wouldn't stay. And I kept on injecting, I kept on injecting, and I realized it wouldn't stay. And then I got into rehab. But this desire keeps you wanting what you can't have, because it's this yearning, thirsting, craving, lusting, clinging. Because, you know, it's a strong pull. It's said in the Dharma that there's no fire hotter than this type of craving, and no ice colder than hatred. And I love this one, no fog thicker than unawareness, not seeing clearly into things. And it's powerful to say that it's not, and I want to just name this, it's not that in the Dharma that we say that like desire, or craving, or clinging is a sin, or it's morally wrong. But from the psychological point of view, it's a cause of suffering. And why? Because it can never fulfill what we want. We keep on having to go back to it. Keep on, like my friend with the heroin, like it just, even though the feeling was like, I'm finally home, it feels wonderful, I just want to stay here forever, it doesn't last. So it's a cause of some suffering. This is a beautiful translation. This is part of the Siddhartha's now becoming the awakening Buddha's beginning to understand about these causes of suffering. And here's a beautiful translation by Ajahn Amaro, an English monk. He says, the noble truth of suffering is ignorance that brings on craving, and it's a type of a craving that is compelling and intoxicating. You know about that one? Compelling and intoxicating. Yeah, we're human, right? We know that. And it causes us to be born into things again and again and again because it's so compelling and intoxicating. It feels so good. Ever seeking delight now here and now here, namely it's the craving for sensual delights, the craving to be something or someone, and the craving to feel nothing. So we could say that, just to unpack this a little bit, this craving for sensual delights, so I'll speak about each of these a little bit. So the craving for sensual delight is like eros, libidinal desire. It's strong, it's instinct. And it's powerful because we can lose ourselves in it because it feels so good. And I'm personally just really interested, like, why is it that I love to lose myself into something pleasurable? I've sat with it and studied with it for years. And I have to admit, I still love it. But the thing is, where do I go? Why do I love it so much? And as far as what I can understand why I love it so much is because there's no I there anymore. There's no Bob. There's just pleasure. It's like losing oneself into pleasure. There's no one there that's suffering. It's to feel good. And we can find that in many things, from sex, food, shopping. I mean, it just goes all over the place. And I know some of you heard my story about eating my favorite vegan ice cream, and I was just like eating it, and I was just like in total ecstasy. It's just like just oneness with the universe. There's no Bob show. There's no Bob show whatsoever. There was just ice cream and satiation, the experience of being satiated, pleasure. But then I all of a sudden saw there was one bite left, and I didn't know what to do. Like the whole weather, like the New England weather system, it just began to change very abruptly. It got cloudy, got cold, stormy. And then I thought to myself, well, I can go get another cup. I there's still a little bit more in the freezer. But I saw myself saying that, and I didn't get it. But I'm interested, like the seduction, because there's this yearning to want to feel home, to feel safe. That's why perhaps that heroin, they felt so good, or just even, you buy it on Amazon, one click, you get it. It sends off little juices of happy, happy things. Judd Brewer from Brown is studying all, like, what happens when you get an email, what happens when you get this. It's like these little opioids that are going off. It's pleasurable. But it's also so seductive. I want more. I want more. Kabir writes, "Friend, please tell me what I can do about this world that I hold on to, but it keeps on spinning out. I gave up sewn clothes, and I wore a robe. But then one day I noticed the cloth was well woven, so I bought some burlap. But I still throw it elegantly over my left shoulder. I pulled back my sexual longings, and now I discover I'm angry a lot. I gave up rage, and now I notice I'm greedy all day. I worked hard at dissolving the greed, and now I'm proud of myself. This poem goes on forever. It'll never end. It'll never end." Perhaps that's why the Stones sing, "I just can't get no satisfaction." We all commiserate around this. We sing together in bars and places and dances. We just can't get no satisfaction. It's like we kind of all know this already. No matter how much I try, and I try, and I try, I just can't get no, and we commemorate about it. But like, this is a truth, no matter how much we try. And again, I don't want to paint such a bummer picture here. It's all in our relationship of how we are with these things, because things are all right. But if we somehow think that these things is what's going to bring us our ultimate happiness, you know, I don't know. There's a story once of Bill Gates at the Seattle airport. He would do a lot of international flying, formerly the wealthiest person in the world. And he got to the habit of stopping at this newsstand with this person that just sold newspapers. And they became a little bit acquainted. And at one point, Bill came up to get a newspaper and reached in his pocket, didn't have any money with him. And the guy says, "It's okay. You can have it." And he says, and Bill said, "Do you know who I am?" He goes, "Oh yeah, you're Bill Gates. You're the wealthiest guy in the world." and Bill said, "Yeah. So next time I come, I'll definitely pay you back." But you know, like, I've seen how you're doing your operation here. You could be doing something else. You could be selling more newspapers, making more. And the guy said, "You know, Bill, I'm kind of happy with what I'm doing. It's enough." Bill Gates told this story. Like, contentment is the greatest of wealth. We cannot buy contentment. Contentment is supreme. So it's in our relationship to things, as I was saying. And there's a beautiful story by Achen Cha, who's a Thai forest meditation teacher. He was once giving a Dharma talk about how much he loved his teacup. And, of course, he had many times in the past said, well, you know, these cravings and unawareness lead to a lot of suffering. And, you know, he's the one that said, if you let go a little, you'll have a little happiness. If you let go a lot, you'll get a lot of happiness. If you let go completely, you'll have complete happiness. But there, now he is talking about how much he loves his teacup, and the people listening to the Dharma talk are going, is he starting to lose some of his cognitive faculties? So finally, somebody at the end said to Achancha, you've been talking all about how much you love this teacup, and I don't get it, because, you know, you've been talking about clinging, you know, it leads to a lot of suffering. And he laughed and said, I love my teacup. And he goes, part of why I love it so much is because I do love it. But I also know that it's broken. One day it'll break. But in the meantime, I'm going to enjoy. And I loved that sense of, like, what? Yeah, we have all these things. And I'm, you know, personally, I'm glad I have the things that I have. But I also know that, you know, it's my favorite shirt. It's going to get worn. My pants are going to get worn. My socks are going to get worn. My hair is going to fall out of my head. My prostate's going to get bigger and make it harder to pee. I mean, it's just like what's our relationship to these things? That's perhaps where our practice, our understanding, how do we meet and be with whatever it is that we have in wise ways, enjoying, but also knowing they come and they go. Sometimes our culture gives the illusion that if you just get this and have that, then you'll be okay. And I remember once in an MBSR class many years ago, there was an engineer that enrolled into the class, and he shared at some point, you know, when I was young, people said, if you get good grades in school, you'll be successful. So I got good grades in school. And then people said later, if you become an engineer, then that will be the thing. So I became an engineer. And then someone said that, you know, you get a nice house and a BMW. So I got a nice house. I got a BMW. Then someone said, getting a house and a boat in Tahoe. Well, I was able to get a boat and a house in Tahoe. And, you know, I don't know who I am. What is all this? I remember him sharing this, and everyone in the class was just like stunned with his genuineness and honesty. Like, I don't have a clue about where to find happiness. I got all these things. Yeah, it touched my heart. Second is this craving to be someone. You could say it's kind of like egocentricity, narcissism. It's built upon the sense of there's a profound, deep insecurity. So I have to look outside for verification of my worth and specialness. And we can see this in the world and political figures and elsewhere. This, you know, that we need to look for this validation outside of us to be someone. It's actually kind of a sad but wise and humorous story. My old meditation teacher, Rina Sirkar, used to tell this story of that a number of years ago in Burma, there was a person there that... just shaved his head and put on robes, and he would say that he was the Buddha. And he walking around, and I'm the Buddha, and you got to pay respects to me. And he was not ordained monk. He had some mental health problems. And so he ended up actually in a mental hospital and was there for a period of time and actually made great progress in recognizing this, you know, delusion of grandeur. And one day, the president of Burma was visiting these medical facilities and happened to come to the one that he was at, President Ne Win. And this person saw all this big crowd around this person that was talking. And so he came up, and then he kind of went through the crowd, said, who are you? And Naaman says, I'm Naaman. I'm the president of Burma. He goes, well, you know, a year and a half ago, I thought I was the Buddha. You got to stay here longer. You're not Naaman. But this craving to be someone, and it has opposite sides of inflation and deflation. Many years ago at a meditation retreat, I happened to look outside, and there was one man that was walking incredibly slowly and deliberately. I could, wow. Like he was lifting and moving and placing. There was a certain beauty to how he was just walking. It was kind of like sometimes in the ocean, these old clipper ships with the sails, and they're just kind of majestic. And so he was walking, lifting, moving, and placing. And later in the retreat, I had a discussion with him, and then he shared that that at one point in the retreat, he was doing this walking meditation. And I got a kind of a sense, I wonder if he was talking about this particular moment. And I said, yeah. And I said, I was doing this walking meditation, and I looked around the meditation retreat, and I realized I was the best walking meditator in the whole retreat. Inflation. And then virtually a moment after that, how could I even think such grand, this, what an ego, like I'm the worst meditator. So it's so interesting, these inflations and deflations. The craving to be someone or something, to create, like it's born out of a profound, at times, insecurity that I have to look outside for my own worth. Facebook has kind of this illusion, and I know I've been caught with it some years ago, where I saw I had 199 likes on something I put out, and I saw my mind say, wouldn't it be nice to get 200? And then I thought later, like, what? Like, would 200 do it? No, it didn't. I want to get 201. It's so funny how this mind is. But where's it born out of? Somehow looking outside for verification of our own being. And it's interesting because when we were born, there's a certain type of sovereignty that we all came in with. And it's very beautiful. John Kabat-Zinn and his wife, Myla, they wrote a very beautiful book called Everyday Blessings about mindful parenting. And they speak about three very important qualities, is to have acceptance for your child and to have empathy. And the third is to honor their sovereignty, which is a very beautiful way. And you know, my wife and I, we've been blessed with two grandsons, one that's about 8 months, the other who's 3 years. And it's just a fresh reminder, like just being around them, but particularly the infant, like we all came in this way, fully sovereign. We didn't care what anyone else thought about us. Like if I had Otis up here with me right now, if he had to take a poop in front of all of you, he'd just poop his brains out. If he wants to pee, he'll pee in front of you. He'll vomit in front of you. He'll laugh. He'll cry. And we all, he's just being a baby. He's a baby. There's such sovereignty. We were all once like that. And what happened along the way? Our conditioning, our personality, our development. It's important for us to remember we didn't come in that way. We came in sovereign. Perhaps that's why Bishop Nipo Sayaka, when he looked at me, said, I see inside you the awakening Buddha. It's already there. I could see the sovereignty, even though I couldn't see it because due to my conditioning, I'm the opposite of all that. Because of these strong beliefs and identifications and conditioning and narratives and stories. So this is the gift of our practice as we awaken, as we become more aware. We've been sitting with these stories all week here. Maybe beginning to discover there's more to me than just these narratives and these stories, these identifications and beliefs. How many times have we left ourselves trying to fit in, to be accepted? And it's, of course, I'm not putting that down for us. It's so human to want to be accepted, to want to be seen, to want to be honored and held. And is it to be found outside or perhaps inside? But if we don't know that, we keep on looking outside to create, to become. I almost could say that the theme song for this is from a country western song, I'm looking for love in all the wrong places. It's wonderful, like, just to see in our own cultures, like, there's such profound wisdom there. Looking for love in all the wrong places. I can't get no satisfaction no matter how much I try. We can touch upon these. The third is the craving to feel nothing, thanatos, the death instinct, annihilation. It's about numbing, disassociating, disconnecting, losing ourselves in drug, alcohol. I mean, TV, crossword puzzles. I mean, just anything so that I don't have to be here. And, you know, middle path here. I mean, I trust a number of us have our things that we love to do that give us relaxation. But it's powerful to take like this, at times, this craving to not want to feel, not to want to be here. And I remember some years ago, fortunately everything is fine, but one of our sons had an illness and there was a possibility that he may have had lymphoma, some cancer. Fortunately, he didn't and had something different. But I remember during that time, and I was actually working on a talk about the noble truths, and I didn't relate that much to the craving to feel nothing. But during that time, I saw inside myself that the possibility that my son would have cancer and die was just too much. It was too much, and I just wanted to sleep. And I never had that experience before. I just wanted to sleep. I did not want to feel this. I did not want to be here. So I'd sleep, and then I'd wake up, and it'd be okay for about 1 second, and then that foreboding, oh, what if? And then like, oh, this is what the craving to feel nothing in an extreme way is like. I just did not want to be here and feel. And then I began to realize, yeah, there's many different times as I begin to look more closely inside myself, of places where I turn away, I just don't want to feel, numb out, whatever. And So Simon and Garfunkel, I'm a rock, I'm an island. A rock feels no pain, an island never cries. This sense of not feeling. And it's powerful for us in the journey because I also just want to appreciate our yearning to want to be whole, to be loved, to be held, to be safe. It's not wrong. It's not bad. It's beautiful. And again, where is it to be found? And, you know, when you think about it, like we were born in a sense of interconnectedness, in the sense that the sperm and the egg of our parents met together and boom, there we were. We got created. And then we were in a womb and we still have that remnant right here of where we were connected to our mother, the placenta. I always get scared. What do we have today for lunch? I always get placenta in the other end. The thing we had for lunch today. Yeah, we didn't have that. We had placenta. Sometimes I get those confused and people, what? But we came from a place of connection. There was literally this connection with our mother, umbilical cord connected to our belly. There's that sense of home and oneness. And then eventually we get born. And then eventually at some point, it's very powerful, that umbilical cord gets cut. And this separation. I know at times I'll go, oh, I just want to get back to my mother, but she's 94 now and I'm too big, it would not work. But like that yearning to want to be home, to feel safe, to be held, to be loved, to be connected. Where is it to be found? This to me is part of what the awakening Buddha was beginning to understand, that these to come back home, if you will, is to recognize these places where we get caught, where we're grasping on or pushing away or not seeing clearly. And then this further type of understanding arose that there's a way to its lessening by the lessening of greed and hatred and ignorance, if you will. By the lessening of unawareness and seeing more clearly and developing deeper understanding that there is a way, a very great realization, there's a way to its lessening. Lessening of ignorance, and greed, hatred. And that there's a path, which is the I'm just touching upon it so briefly, but that there's a path that we can walk upon that supports this lessening, that supports this deeper understanding, cultivating our virtue and steadying the mind, the cultivation of wisdom. That there's a way. The Buddha describes part of this awakening from Udana. And says, this is about regarding Nibbana. He says, there is, bhikkhus, a base where there is no earth, no water, no fire, no air, no base consisting of infinity of space, no base consisting of infinity of consciousness, no base consisting of nothingness, no base consisting of neither perception nor non-perception, neither this world nor another world, nor both, neither sun nor moon. Here, bhikkhus, I say there is no coming and no going, no saying, staying, and no deceasing, no uprising, not fixed, not movable. It has no support. This is the end of suffering. Experiencing the unconditioned. And of course, perhaps the way to experience the unconditioned is with our awareness, is to begin to see through the conditioning. The stories, the identifications, the narratives, the beliefs that spin us around and around. And so in this process, rather than traveling in this world of self-referencing, we're now beginning to develop self-awareness, beginning to see the places where we're tangled so that we can potentially untangle. So in the meantime, let's just be together. Han Shan was a Chinese poet from 1,000 years ago, and he kind of said that we're all like kind of bugs in a bowl. all day. Yep. Going around and around, never leaving their bowl. And I say, that's right. Every day climbing up the bowl and sliding back down and doing it over and over again. Well, you can sit in the bottom of the bowl, put your head in your hands. You can cry. You can moan. You can feel sorry for yourself, or you can look around. You can look around. You can see your fellow bugs. You can say, hey, how you doing? Hey, nice bowl. It's that possibility. Fellow bugs in the bowl. Hey, how you doing? Nice bowl. So let's just sit for a few moments. And so I'll end with a very beloved poem from Wu Men, who's a Chinese poet. Many years ago, I was in Beijing teaching, and I recited this poem at the end, and the translator was translating it, then all of a sudden, everybody in the audience started reciting it. They all knew this poem. This was a beloved poem that's taught in early school. And it speaks about moments. It speaks about moments and to take it in. The first moment is 10,000 flowers in spring. The moon in autumn. A cool breeze in summer. Snow in winter. If your mind isn't clouded by unnecessary things, this is the best season of your life. If your mind isn't clouded by unnecessary things, this is the best season of your life. And you can make up your own poem, like lots of redwoods, the windblower, the cool air. Your life isn't clouded by unnecessary things. This is the best season of your life. Thank you. So thank you, and time for some walking and perhaps checking out this environment. Make your own moments, life made of moments. Being present. We'll have dinner and be back at the 6:45 sit. Thank you.